Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the June 8th, 2013 meeting of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. It's going to be a short session this morning, and we start with a topic we've been taking up regularly over the past several months, and that is item number 13, hoof disease in Southwest Washington elk populations. This is a briefing. Nate Pamplin and Kristen Mansfield, I haven't seen you in years. I think the last time was when we visited the new Spokane office about 6 years ago, a long time ago. Anyway, welcome.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to hearing your assessment of where things stand. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair, members of the commission. It's a pleasure to be here before you this morning on this topic. It's something that Director Anderson or Chair Wecker has asked me to come to the table and brief you on a few times this winter. It was always uncomfortable because I didn't have our lead, and that's Dr. Mansfield. And so I appreciate you all carving out some time on your agenda, and that Dr. Mansfield was able to come out and we'll review this topic with you. This is an extremely serious issue for the agency. It's causing great concern with the public in Southwest Washington, the hunting community at large, and unfortunately, at the end of the day, we don't have an easy button for this topic. This is not going to necessarily have a happy ending. I think we should collectively try to manage expectations associated with managing a disease. It would be bad enough if it was just within a domestic setting, but when it's in wildlife, there's very limited options that we have. So let me just wanted to share a little bit of background on Dr. Mansfield. She received a Doctor of Veterinary Medicine from UC Davis, has a master's in epidemiology. She's been with the department for 11 years. She's based out of Spokane, and she works with our wildlife biologists and enforcement officers on a wide variety of items, whether it's assisting with actual animal handling and captures for a variety of research projects, to providing guidance to the wildlife rehab program that you heard about yesterday, providing a mobilization training for staff, but also is our lead person for a variety of wildlife disease investigations, whether it's shell rot in western pond turtles, to West Nile virus, to pneumonia outbreaks in bighorn sheep, or to the issue we're going to be talking about today. So we've structured the briefing in four major topics. We're first going to just present an overview of hoof disease in the area. We'll walk through the steps that we've taken and the variety of samples that we've run and the results of those sampling efforts. Then I've asked Dr. Mansfield to just provide just a general overview of disease management concepts, and we'll be looking at some examples from domestic livestock, and then I'll come back to the mic and walk through just exploring some of the different management options that might be available to us once we know and isolate what the root cause is, and then would be working forward towards implementation. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Mansfield.
Nate, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. As Nate indicated, this is a very serious disease, and I would say this is by far the most troubling and disturbing disease I've ever worked with in my nearly 20 years as a veterinarian. We're going to talk about what we have learned so far, what we know about it, but just as importantly, what we still need to learn and what we need to know in order to take steps forward on this disease. So I'll start with just a background on wild ungulate hoof diseases. They're not uncommon. We get reports every year from throughout the state of hoof diseases of some kind or another in wild ungulates. They're usually sporadic, and there's a variety of different causes. These pictures are from three cases we had just last fall in eastern Washington. We have an elk that had septic arthritis. In the middle, we have a moose that had a sole abscess, and on the far right we have hooves from a mule deer suffering from chronic cellulitis. So hoof disease per se isn't unusual, or historically has not been unusual in the state for as long as I've been here. In 2008, early 2008, in the Cowlitz River Basin lowlands, from that area, I should say, we began to receive a lot more reports, more than just our background number of reports that we receive of hoof disease in ungulates throughout the state. What was different about this was the really drastic increase in the number, and then the appearance that it seemed to be spreading very rapidly in a very short time. These were pictures we received from the public, from hunters. These are elk that were harvested or found dead, and these are examples of some of the hoof lesions, I should say, that were being seen in these elk. Our initial assessment, or the initial feedback we heard or observed, was that it affected both males and females. It affected all ages, young animals, up to mature animals and old animals. It didn't seem to be affecting any particular hoof. It could be front or back, right or left. But when I interviewed large animal veterinarians who practiced in the area to see if they were seeing anything similar in livestock, they said no changes in livestock as far as they could tell. So we started asking questions and trying to figure out how we were going to go about our investigation. So beginning with what we know about hoof diseases in general, and all this comes from domestic animals, much better studied, of course, there can be infectious causes caused by bacteria, viruses, fungus could be on there, endophyte toxicity. And what this is, it's a fungus that affects grass, and it's not like a man-made toxin. It's a natural toxin from a fungus that affects grass and is consumed by animals and causes gangrene and sloughing of the hooves in domestic species. There could be non-infectious causes. We know nutritional imbalances, zinc deficiencies, selenium deficiencies, copper deficiencies can affect the structure of the hoof, causing them to become weaker and more prone to infection and breakage. Chronic laminitis is a common thing in domestic animals. It's just chronic inflammation of the lamina, which is a part of the hoof that grows the keratin that becomes the hard part of the hoof. Lots of causes of that. Behavioral changes, if they're just standing around a lot in soft ground, not wearing the hoof off the way they normally would. There's a couple genetic inherited conditions described in cattle. There's remotely some parasites that could cause problems in of hooves. But in many cases, it's multifactorial. For example, if you have a healthy animal that's exposed to a particular bacteria, it may not get an infection. But if you have a malnourished animal that's exposed to the same bacteria, it does get infected. So it's usually frequently a combination of factors, and then the environment has a really huge impact on that. So in general, despite the list of possible causes I just went through, the hoof responds to disease in kind of a stereotypic way. It kind of responds in the same manner no matter what the original cause is. And it begins with inflammation, especially of the lamina, that important part of the hoof that produces the keratin that becomes the hard hoof. From that, you get abnormal growth of the hoof. You get uneven wear as a result of that. That can cause sole ulcers on the bottom of the feet because of the uneven wear. Those ulcers get infected with bacteria, and if allowed to proceed, the whole hoof capsule can even slough. This is important to keep in mind, kind of this non-specific response to diseases, the way the hoof responds to disease, as we talk about some of the diagnostic results we've received and the approaches we've taken for getting a diagnosis. So other questions we had initially, is this a brand new disease in elk, never described before? Well, obviously it was, but you know, a disease that hasn't been described in livestock either. Or could this be spillover of an infectious hoof disease from livestock? There are several in livestock. especially where they are raised in wet areas like Southwest Washington or the UK has a big problem because they're pretty wet there. There's a disease called foot rot of domestic sheep. It can also affect cattle sometimes, but it's a bigger problem for sheep. And then there's another disease that emerged in the dairy industry not too many years ago called papillomatous digital dermatitis, or PDD. This disease was first described, first became a problem in the early 90s in the dairy industry and spread very rapidly, and now is pretty much everywhere where dairy cattle are produced in the U.S. And both of these diseases share a characteristic of being caused by bacteria that persist in soil and manure and are really perpetuated under wet, dirty conditions. So in beginning our investigations, we sought assistance and advice from the veterinary school, WSU. In the field, we had veterinary staff from our agency, from Washington State University, University of Washington. We had the ODF&W vet, who was my counterpart. We had a PhD candidate from Oregon State University. University of Washington and Tufts University. Is that better? Is that too close? Okay. And we have sent lab samples to all these following labs. They're listed here. I don't need to read them, I guess. So again, our first reports were received in early 2008, and that's, you know, over the ensuing few months after 2008. It's like, okay, this is really something. We got to get on this. As soon as we could, considering hunting seasons and landowner access issues and logistics and funding, et cetera, all those things, we went out into the field in March of 2009 for our initial systematic diagnostic investigation of what was going on, and actually collected some animals to and subjected them to all of these lab tests, gross necropsy, radiographs, histology, parasitology, virus isolation, looked at trace minerals, and then ran routine bacteriology. The results from our 2009 investigation were that this is what we could conclude. It appeared to be a primary hoof disease. It wasn't, for example, a secondary effect of, say, a generalized virus infection. It did seem to be limited to the hooves. All the other tissues we looked at were normal. It's not going. Okay. We found what we could describe looking at these things under the microscope and on radiographs was that we could say we are seeing chronic, nonspecific changes in these hooves. And this kind of goes back to that list of kind of the sequence of how disease develops in hooves. The animals we looked at were so far down that progression that we could just see the end changes. We couldn't really decipher what the inciting cause might have been. And we had abundant nonspecific bacterial overgrowth that it was just kind of bacteria that we know are out there in the mud and in manure and things like that. It didn't really tell us anything specific. We did identify that they were copper and selenium deficient, but that wasn't a surprise because we know this part of the state, the soils are very deficient in copper and selenium, and livestock are supplemented in these areas because of that deficiency. So again, our conclusions were nonspecific chronic changes of hooves means we need to look at these hooves much earlier in that disease process, which we decided, put that on the shelf, I'll come back to that. And then the nonspecific bacterial growth we found that told us that we need to use some specialized microbiology. We're just kind of getting the background gunk when we look, so we need to do something a little more different. We did follow up on the low copper and selenium levels. We did that by looking at archived serum that I have in my lab in Spokane and compared the herds in Southwest Washington with herds throughout the state. And they were low, but they weren't the lowest in the state. There were some that were much lower, and those animals were perfectly healthy. So it doesn't mean that the low copper and selenium is not significant. It just means it's probably not the primary cause. So given that we were only seeing chronic changes during our first investigation, that told us we need to find animals very early in the disease to maximize our chances of finding out what that primary inciting cause is. and we need to do our specialized bacteriology. And we need to see if the results we got in 2009 are repeatable. Are we seeing the same thing, or have things changed since then? So this past March, we focused on collecting younger animals. So we collected young of the year, which at that time were 8 to 9 months old. We selected 3 different study sites, our affected area in Cowlitz County and Lewis County. We had 9 animals from there. I think it was 5 from one county and 4 from the other. We had a West Side control group, which was Pacific County. We collected 3 control animals from there, a non-affected area of Pacific County. And we also collected 4 animals from the east side of the state, 2 from Kittitas and 2 from Yakima County. I had engaged with some of the hoof rot disease specialists in the world, and one of the top ones is at the University of Liverpool, about doing the specialized microbiology we need, and also a lab at the USDA National Animal Disease Center that's doing a lot of research on this bacteria that's causing all the problems in the dairy industry. So this is a pretty information-dense slide. I apologize, but I just wanted to present what we did and what we found. We repeated, and this is just of the hooves, and my next slide I'll go over kind of the general background health, but just looking at the hooves, our routine bacteriology done at WSU, this wasn't the specialized bacteriology, we just got kind of the background contamination junk that you get. No significant findings there. The specialized bacteriology that was sent to the University of Liverpool, it's specialized because those bugs are super, super hard to grow, and they take a long time to grow, and they are still working on those. I'm talking to the guy weekly, and it's just taking a long time to kind of isolate what's in those samples that we sent them. There may be some follow-up bacteriology done at Colorado State University and possibly University of Sydney, because the other livestock hoof disease I talked about, the one that affects sheep, is a huge, huge problem in Australia and New Zealand, where the sheep industries are very huge. And so all the experts on that particular disease are in Australia and New Zealand. So we may be sending some to there eventually. It's just hard to get import permits to send infectious material to another country. We repeated our radiology at Colorado State University. What we're looking for there is bone involvement, primary bone involvement. My very first slide showing the 3 species with various hoof diseases. You know, one of those had septic arthritis, which would show up on radiographs. But on our elk, those were pretty non-significant. There were changes, of course, where the hoof had sloughed, and so the bone was exposed, so you know that was there, but that was a secondary effect of the bone of the hoof sloughing. We sent off multiple tissues for virus isolation at the University of Wyoming. They have the most expertise in virus isolation of wildlife in the country. No significant viruses there. Histology, which is the microscopic examination of tissues, was done at Colorado State University. That's been done, but the pathologist doing that, she's not finding any, smoking guns, but she wants to kind of send out photos to other pathologists throughout the country to kind of get their opinions on what she's seeing there. Probably nothing really earth-shattering is going to come out of that. And then we have saved multiple hoof biopsies in my lab in Spokane, saved under a number of different preservatives and conditioning conditions for future studies. They're available if we think of other things that we need to test for. So that's the hooves. This is just kind of the general health background sampling and testing. Histology, again, microscopic examination of all the tissues, including muscle, which is meat. And that's been completed, and there's no evidence of significant inflammation or infection in any other organs above the hooves. And this is even in the very severely affected animals with really bad-looking hooves. And the significance and importance of this is, we get concerns frequently or questions from hunters about is the meat safe to eat? And I'd say based on our histology done in both 2009 and 2013, we're finding nothing above the hooves. So I'm comfortable saying the meat is safe to eat. We repeated our trace minerals, same thing, low copper and selenium, as expected. Might have some effects, but it's probably not the primary problem. Zinc was was not deficient. Zinc is another important mineral for hoof health, but that looked fine. Parasitology, that's basic basic screen, nothing came up there, similar loads in all three groups. We did serology, which is testing their serum for exposure to a variety of infectious viruses in this case that potentially could cause some damage to the blood supply to the hoof. These are viruses that are known to do that in other species, but our elk pretty much came up negative for exposure to any of those. We do have some serology pending at the USDA lab in Ames, Iowa, for this particular bacteria that causes the problem in dairy cows. And just like with the hoof biopsies, we've saved back multiple tissues and samples just for future studies should we think of other things to test for. So our summary is our findings were very similar to 2009. A little bit surprising to us was that even in calves that were younger that we hoped we'd catch an earlier disease and help us figure out what the heck is starting this, they had hooves that looked every bit as bad as the ones we collected in 2009. So what this means is that we may have to look at even younger calves, and based on the feedback I get from the bacteriologist and the pathologist in the next couple weeks, we may even be looking at collecting calves that are born this year just to get them as soon as they're infected to hopefully figure out what is starting this disease before it goes so far that we can't tell what started it. And we still have our specialized microbiology pending, as I said. So, you know, back to the beginning, where do we go? It made sense to us diagnostically to start with bacteria that we know cause similar diseases in livestock, and we know that are present in that part of the state in livestock. Not wanting to pinpoint livestock or anything, but just diagnostically kind of made sense to rule those out first. So it's the two that I've referred to a few times to already. One is Dicyclobacter nidosis in sheep, and this is the one that all the experts are in Australia and New Zealand. So if we decide we need to go that avenue, we can, but there's going to be a lot of hoops to jump through to get the material there. We didn't have a problem getting samples to the UK for some reason. They're not quite as stringent. So we are pursuing the possibility that this bacteria that is the dairy cow problem is possibly involved with the elk. I hope we have some results back. I'm not ready to say what they mean because the researcher is not ready to say what they mean, but we're getting more results in each day. And in fact, this coming week, he has isolated what looks like a treponeme from our samples, and he has sent them off for DNA sequencing. And those results were supposed to be back Friday, but there's like a time lag between us and UK. And I don't know what those are, but those sequencing results may tell us something significant or may not. There have been a few inquiries from citizens about the possibility of a disease called leptospirosis causing the hoof disease that we're seeing in elk. There's really no support for this being a possibility in the veterinary world, but nonetheless, we did want to rule that out. So from our 16 animals we collected this past March, the 9 from the affected area, the 7 from unaffected areas, we did submit those for serology, which just tests whether the animals have been exposed to any of these 6 serovars of Leptospira. Some came back positive at very low titers, which wasn't a surprise. We know leptospirosis is everywhere, especially in wet areas of the state and especially in many species of wildlife. And these were our results. 1 of 3 from Pacific County had antibodies. 1 out of the 4 in Region 3 had antibodies, and 2 out of 9 in Region 5 had antibodies. And the titers were very low, which means very low exposure, which you would expect just from background exposure. If there was an active infection, you'd expect a very high titer in the thousands. And these are just the actual results from the lab from this particular set of animals. So not wanting to turn this into a disease ecology lecture, but I just wanted to put a couple of concepts out there because they really are important for setting the framework for potential actions we may or may not be able to take. Central to this is the concept of the disease triad. meaning that for disease to occur, there are three important interacting factors. There's the host, which in this case is the elk. There's the agent, which we don't know in this case, but we suspect may be a bacterial agent. And there's the environment. So for examples purposes only, let's say this is an infectious bacteria causing the disease in elk. And as is the case in sheep and cattle, the bacteria persist in the soil under wet conditions. So under this concept of the disease triad, you could have the elk, you could have the bacteria, but if it's bone dry, the bacteria is not going to survive and be there to infect elk. Likewise, you could have the elk in a wet environment, but if that bacteria is nowhere to be found, you're not going to have disease. Disease only occurs where there's the appropriate interaction of host, pathogen, and environment. And when you start talking about management, disease management concepts or options or tools, those tools are directed at one of these three factors of the disease triad. So in veterinary medicine and human medicine too, I would say there's basically four categories of disease management. The first and best, of course, is prevention. And honestly, in wildlife, this is just about the only tool we have. And it's very analogous to invasive species, invasive aquatic species, or invasive species of any kinds. It's far easier to prevent than to try to deal with it afterwards, because when something gets out in the wild, you really lose a lot of control. So this is why in our agency we put a lot of emphasis on prevention when it comes to wildlife disease, and we do that by we did that very wisely a couple decades ago by banning game farms, deer and elk ranches, which was very fortuitous because we have a lot of states in the nation now that just have a big old mess because they allowed deer and elk farming and disease got into the deer farms and then got into the wild and they can't control it now. So our agency takes that very seriously. Another example is movement restrictions. We're pretty restrictive to the degree that we are allowed to, the law allows, as far as bringing in wild animals from other states or other countries. General, most of these examples are going to be just from livestock and domestic domestic animals and humans to a degree. As I go on, very few of these have actually been tried, much less been successful in wildlife. So anyway, prevention is our biggest tool, and here's some examples of it. If you can't prevent it, maybe you can control its severity. In a domestic animal, that might include antibiotics, dewormers, depending on the disease, and there you're operating on that host part of the triad there. You can vaccinate to reduce shedding. Vaccination, it depends on the vaccine and the disease. Sometimes vaccines are effective in preventing infection. Sometimes they don't prevent infection, but they lower the amount of pathogen that is spread by the animal, and so they slow the disease down that way. With some diseases, if they happen to be a density-dependent disease in particular, if there's like more animals, which facilitates transmission of the agents. If it's a disease, a density-dependent disease, if you reduce the density, you can control the disease. If it's a pathogen in the soil, which it may be in the case of our elk hoof disease, density may or may not do anything for you if the animal's going to get the disease, whether there's two animals or whether there's 2,000 animals. Or you can modify, another control example is modify the environment to minimize the interaction of host and pathogen. And this is an example of this would be, say, draining a pond to, you know, prevent mosquitoes from breeding, which might, you know, that would reduce then the transmission of West Nile virus. Eradication is the third tool. You eliminate the host, basically. No host, no disease. Or it can be directed at the pathogen, too. Sometimes you can succeed in eradicating the parasite or the bacteria or the disease. Or you destroy the habitat that's required for that transmission to occur. A third approach is laissez-faire, hands-off, let nature take its course. An argument for this approach, in theory anyway, is that if you just let things be, perhaps over time, the host will evolve and have more resistance or immunity, or as frequently occurs, at least in, well, not, it really does occur, is over time the pathogen becomes less virulent. They just kind of co-evolve, and so that they can exist together. And kind of backing up and sort of, you know, so how would some of these examples be applied in a domestic animal situation, and specifically a domestic animal with a hoof disease? Again, hoof diseases are not uncommon in domestic animals. So if a dairy producer went to their vet and said, hey, I really want to control hoof rot in my dairy herd, can you give me some tips? Well, here's what you would need to do. Maintain a clean, dry environment. Don't bring in any new animals without quarantining them or treating them, because that's one way you can introduce a pathogen into a new population. So quarantine new animals before introducing to the rest of the herd. Trim the feet a couple times a year. Get rid of that kind of rotten tissue that allows the bacteria to persist and grow within the hoof. When you do that, disinfect your instruments in between cows so you don't spread the disease between them. Set up a foot bath. Every time they go to and from the milking parlor, they walk through this foot bath and kind of, you know, kill some bacteria on the way in and out. In individual animals, you can give injectable or topical antibiotics depending on what the bacteria is and depending on whether they're susceptible to that antibiotic and depending on whether you can get a high enough concentration in the cows to really have enough antibiotic there to kill the organisms. Vaccination. There is a vaccine available for the hoof rot in sheep, but it's only effective against certain strains of Dyclobacter. If you provide basic good nutrition, including trace minerals, that just kind of boosts their general health and immunity, might make them a little more resistant to diseases of all sorts. And if you can't fix it, if you're treating it and it's not getting better, you cull them, you get rid of them so that they're not there as a source of infection to the rest of the animals. And just as an aside, in the dairy industry, hoof disease is the third most common reason for getting rid of your cows, because you just can't clear up the hoof disease. And in cattle, it does affect milk production quite a bit. Eradication. There are very few examples of this being successful on a wide scale. It can be accomplished, of course, on a small farm or a very small restricted area where you can control all the factors that might be influencing the occurrence of disease there. But large-scale attempts, again, in New Zealand and Australia, well-organized, well-funded, multi-decade, mandatory, everybody has to participate, still have not been able to eradicate hoof disease in domestic sheep there. So just as a recap, what might be available to us with our elk, prevention isn't going to happen. That it's here. It's too late for prevention. But perhaps we can prevent the spread. We can discuss that. Control, these are just the examples from domestic situations, but we can maybe control the disease. We're not going to eradicate it. I'm pretty sure there's no way we're going to eradicate this disease. There's always the fourth option of let nature take its course. So this is just kind of the overall framework and overview. And I think I will now turn it over to Nate to talk about, you know, if we were to want to try to do some of these things, you know, what are some things to be considered?
Thank you. So some key management questions that are in front of us right now. First off is just, okay, the disease is present, but what does this mean in terms of how often do elk actually die with hoof disease or from as a result of hoof disease? What is the effect of hoof disease on productivity? Are we seeing an impact to recruitment? Does the hoof disease actually reduce breeding or likelihood of carrying a calf to term? Overall, what is the effect on the population, whether it just ultimately results in a population decline, and it'll be very important for us to monitor the overall health of the herd. So taking some of the examples from domestic situations and applying them to Southwest Washington, And I'm just presenting this just as the types of options that our technical team is starting to consider and deliberate. I don't have a path forward at this stage, but just to kind of share with you what's within the realm of possibility. Well, one possibility is that, well, we could reduce elk density. This might have the positive benefits of reducing transmission and advancement. It might also actually have a density-dependent response, so that we actually have more forage essentially available to the remaining animals, have that healthier herd condition, as Dr. Mansfield indicated, that might make them less susceptible to having the disease be onset. By culling animals, we could do this in a couple different ways. We could target the removal for animals that we see exhibiting these signs. We could just do an overall increase of recreation permits. As an aside, this Mount St. Helens elk herd has been at a population level that exceeds our population objective, and we've already been very liberal with antlerless permits, trying to bring the overall herd down to our population management objective. So perhaps there's something more that can be done there, again, trying to get that density-dependent response. We could focus our removal on that fringe area. Perhaps it's something where, okay, here's the core area where the disease is set, and we're not going to be able to do much removals there, but maybe we kind of do almost like a wildfire approach. You go to the boundary where we're trying to remove animals so that it reduces the chances of transmission into adjacent populations. All of this would be probably done at a very local level. I mean, when we talk about landscape level culling, that's pretty extensive. Of course, then kind of the other aspects of reducing elk density. How effective would this actually be? So we remove a bunch of elk. If the bacteria, if that's the root cause, is still in the soil, and then the population rebounds, well, we've got the problem again. Are we able to see some immunity in certain animals and areas? And then overall, as you can imagine, just from the public relations standpoint, would the public tolerance be there for a pretty assertive animal culling operation? Would we be able to access the herd? This is not, again, thinking about doing culling on a domestic situation. All animals are accounted for, and you do the removal. Here we are in a wild population with multiple landowners. Do we have access to those elk to be able to conduct this removal? Another management treatment, again, that we talked about in the domestic setting, could we apply it in the wild setting? Is there a way to treat elk, either by increasing the elk immunity or, again, the nutritious status? So we could do tests on captive elk. We could treat the soil and see whether or not we're actually able to kill the bacteria. Again, achieving a treatment at a landscape level approach will be an extreme challenge. There's the capture, the treat, and release approach. We're talking about Mount St. Helens herd somewhere north of 12,000 animals. So, the feasibility, the logistics of doing a treatment approach could be very difficult. And then also, okay, so we start doing some treatment. Well, will the bacteria that evolves will become develop resistance? And so is the additional work something that doesn't pay off in terms of a long-term benefit? We still don't know if it is bacteria. What is the life cycle of bacteria? How does it behave in different conditions? And if there's a difference of prevalence of hoof disease between wet and dry land? And then will the bacteria persist in the soil? How much is in the soil? Is it something where, because of different elevations, does that have different exposure to moisture or perhaps temperatures that could restrict the growth of bacteria? There's a lot of unknowns here, and so that's the limitations that I just wanted to introduce with treatment. We could also, as Dr. Mansfield indicated, let the disease run its course. We don't know if this will be effective. We could certainly, again, try to test bacteria in different soil conditions. There's already a tremendous amount of public concern. It's very disturbing to watch animals that have this malady limping along, and so I mean, we get calls, and it's the what department, what are you doing about it? Well, it might be, given some of those other factors, it is a let nature run its course. Well, that's not a satisfactory response oftentimes for the public, where the expectation is, you know, kind of carrying on that individual animal basis, what are we doing about it? And overall, a big concern is if this disease has those population level impact, those types of questions that I started this section off with, what's the overall impact to the herd? Again, we hear a variety of options. In a domestic situation, you might fence that animals to prevent, whether it was a disease in wildlife that could impact a domestic herd or vice versa. We have hundreds of miles of elk fence trying to keep elk out at orchards in eastern Washington. Is this something that's considered? And perhaps we're keeping elk within a core area or preventing them into other areas. Well, the feasibility, the cost, the maintenance, there's private property consideration, and also just impacts of putting fences up with wildlife corridors and connectivity. So I think a low chance we'd go that route, but again, just wanted to offer, here's the types of things that folks are talking about on a technical level. Before consideration and implementation, we need to evaluate if any of these management options are truly going to be effective. This is any of those options that we went through are going to be resource intensive, whether it's personnel or just overall funding. So understanding, will this, we actually see a positive benefit to the elk population, considering the cost, the feasibility, and is this something we can sustain over time? You know, looking at the examples of hoof rot in sheep in Australia and New Zealand, this was a decades-long effort, organized effort, hundreds of millions of dollars spent because of the commercial interest and industry aspects, and still no eradication. And so we don't have that kind of resources available to us, and it's even in a more difficult setting because it's in the wild. So we need to be extremely thorough. We're turning over just about every rock we can, as you saw from the different types of samples that we're running and the tests we're looking at to try to understand what the root cause is, but then being extremely thoughtful on how we proceed. So just some kind of stepping back from the hoof disease and investigation, some other things that the department has done. We developed an online hoof disease reporting form to try to get, there's a lot of eyes from the public that are out there. This is a great tool for us from a citizen science component to let us know where the disease is showing up. And so that those have been very valuable. Here's just an example of, you know, this is as of May 23rd, the reported hoof deformities throughout Region 5. So that's been helpful for us to kind of see the prevalence and distribution of the disease. We had a public meeting last fall to walk through what we knew about hoof disease at the time. Again, starting to just kind of share information and try to essentially manage expectations about what can be done for wildlife diseases. We've posted some information on our webpage, and we had a slide earlier that showed the variety of partners that we've been working with to try to understand this issue and the different labs we've been sending samples to. But essentially, we have an ad hoc technical team with ourselves, Washington State University, and Washington Department of Health. We'll also be earlier here in the next month or two set up a public hoof disease working group. Like to invite representatives from county governments, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, major landowners, both public and private, as a way to, one, have an information exchange, but also start vetting some of those different management options that the technical team comes up with, because as you can imagine, there's a lot of pros and cons from the science side, but there's also a lot of pros and cons from the public acceptance side of things. And so we're wanting to have that a forum where we can discuss those issues. We've developed a hoof disease health and safety fact sheet in partnership with the Department of Health. And we also included some information in this year's hunting pamphlet specifically about hoof disease. So for our next steps, the specialized microbiology analyses should be due in here hopefully very soon. As Dr. Mansfield indicated, if we need to collect animals from calves from this year to try to look at the early onset of the disease, then we will do that. So that would be occurring next month if necessary. Continuing to assemble our technical team to review those variety of management options I just went through with you, explore those management options through the public working group, ultimately sharing those with the public, and then implementation of whatever course we decide on. So with that, that concludes our briefing. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Really excellent. Excellent job. Very informative. Look at all these questions. Commissioner Carpenter first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nate and Dr. Mansfield, this probably will come across as a very naive question from someone that doesn't have much knowledge about this, but trying to understand, and perhaps you've already answered it and I just didn't get it, would it not be feasible to tranquilize a pregnant cow, elk, and keep it, retain that animal until the calf is born and try and determine whether the calf get it genetically or actually when it hits the ground in the region that these elk live? I know you've already answered it probably, but I'm thinking about that, trying to figure out when it starts.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Carpenter, that is definitely an answer we need is when is this starting. I think we can accomplish that by collecting the calves shortly after they're born rather than tranquilizing the cow. I mean, I don't know that would be a necessary step to do if we wanted to collect some fairly young calves. I think we get the same information, at least from trying to determine like how this thing starts, what it looks like in the early stages will give us a clue as to what the cause might be, genetic or infectious or whatever.
Do you believe that the calves are born coming out of the womb with the disease, or do you have a sense of that?
No, I don't. Our thought is this is a bacteria that survives in the soil. That's our thought. Now we don't have the evidence to say that, but that's our feeling. And I think as soon as when they get up and start walking around in the infected soil, I think is when they get it. And so if we collected calves, they would be six to eight weeks old. I don't know, it'd be mid-July, 6 to 8 weeks old, so pretty young. Hopefully that 6 to 8 weeks isn't long enough that all those chronic horrible changes occur. Those take time to occur, so hopefully we would be in an earlier stage if we did that.
Thank you.
Commissioner Schmidt, what's next?
Thank you, Chair. I would have paid to hear Dr. Mansfield's report. I appreciate good science, scientific research, and this was excellent. It's obvious there's a great urgency when dealing with this disease, especially if it's a new hoof disease. And our next step is going to be some more scientific investigation, so that's going to take time. My point is really a point for, I think, the Commission and the Department's immediate consideration, is that we need a very coordinated communication strategy to keep the public informed on a regular basis. It's the only way we're going to continue to do what we need to do scientifically. And so that's something I think we can do to allow Dr. Mansfield to do her thing. Thank you.
Commissioner Perry?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I enjoyed your presentation. I thought it was extremely good. I know we've had a lot of public input on this. People just extremely unhappy and criticizing the department for not doing things quicker and so forth. But as Commissioner Smitten said, I too appreciate good science. And it looks like you're going about it in as good a scientific way as we possibly could. And I think that's really positive, and I think it'll be positive in the end. But I wanted to ask a couple of questions. Does this do you see these animals that are affected related to any kind of habitat, specific habitat condition out there, whether it be forested or not forested, or meadow situation rather than a dense forest, or wetlands rather than uplands? Is there any kind of habitat relationship?
Chair Wecker and Commissioner Perry, the question was, is there any apparent association with habitat? And I don't know if I can answer that directly, but maybe indirectly a couple ways. The elk are far more easily observed when they come down into the pastures in Cowlitz and Lewis County, so that's where they're seen. When this first came up in 2008, 2009, when the disease first emerged to the degree that it is now, it seemed to be limited to the lowlands, and we hoped it would stay in the lowlands. But during the last 2 years of our Mount St. Helens helicopter captures, where we had 3 or 4 years prior to that with no hoof disease in those elk, the last couple of years from the helicopter where they could get a good look at herds, it had spread there, and many groups of elk they saw up in the Mount St. Helens, you know, up the hill a ways, were limping. And so I'm afraid it isn't limited to one habitat at this point.
The other question I had was in a given herd that exhibits this stuff, is there animals that don't get it? Is there some immunity in the community as well? And is there any way that could be exploited by maybe captive breeding, or I don't know what that would involve, but I guess my basic question is there some immunity out there as well?
Yeah, the question was whether immunity seems to develop, and that's a question. We'd have to set up some pretty well-designed studies and observe over time, several years over time, to be able to answer that, I'm afraid.
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Caney was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the great presentation, too. I was looking at the prevalence distribution maps of 08 and 09, and it makes me curious if we have those for 10, 11, 12, and whatnot. And when you look at those, you tend to think of it, there's kind of like a red ground zero, you know, where it was really prevalent, and I guess that would be the lowlands. And I'm not familiar with the topography, but the question comes to mind, is it the elk that migrate or move? And my question probably to Nate is, you know, what is the pattern of movement of elk? Are they basically, you know, in one area and they have a 30% infection, and in another area it's only 5%? And is there movement? And would we be radio tracking the elk to see, you know, if they're carrying the disease in their hoofs, the bacterium, if that's what it is, and they're moving from the lowlands up to the St. Helen area, that might help me understand these distributions. But right now it still appears there's a certain set of environmental conditions with the bacterium in certain areas that makes more prevalence no matter what. And there's probably fewer cases in other environmental conditions. And the question just keeps popping out to me is, what are the elk doing? How are they moving through this area to where that bacterium, if that's what it is being moved around? And I'm curious if you're going to be looking at that.
Chair Wecker and Commissioner Caney, the question is, do we have an understanding of elk movement in that area? I'm stationed in Spokane, so I'm not intimately familiar with the movement patterns of the elk, although I understand generally they come down to the pastures during certain times of the year and then up in the industrial timberlands other times of the year. But as far as the westward movement, I really don't know. Do you have any ideas?
Couldn't add anything further, Madam Chair. Commissioner Caney, it's elk. There is going to be an elevational movement that's pretty common But as far as in terms of really spreading around and things, it's going to be where, you know, the way this, if this is bacteria in the soil, it'll be where an infected elk steps and another elk comes in. And so you could see, even if elk are staying within a pretty tight home range, just the overlap of home ranges could allow this disease to transfer.
I'd be just curious, you know, maybe some of the radio collar work on infected animals versus non-infected animals, and if just something could be, you know, sleuthed out of that, you know.
We have an ongoing research project where a number of animals had been radio collared to look at for a sightability model for population estimation. And so I will ask our district wildlife biologist, Pat Miller, to kind of pull together some information, and we can share that with the commission.
And one other thing, I think all the PR that's gone out is great, but like what your presentation today should make in most people's minds feel much more comfortable if they knew this had all gone on, that, you know, the department's doing about everything possible. I mean, if somehow that could be encapsulated into a smaller presentation or a smaller pamphlet or something that just says, you know, we're on this, we're doing what is necessary, what's possible. Explain that there's not always easy solutions, you know, because we heard a lot of people give public testimony that were irate that you weren't doing something. Well, you're doing a lot. So,
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll say first, it's a pleasure knowing that you're on our staff, Dr. Mansfield. Wildlife veterinarian with a master's in epidemiology is exactly the type of skill set that really helps us in a situation like that. Epidemiology is the study of diseases and populations. So, and it was sort of following up on Jay's point, it was also very helpful to learn that you've been on this and the department's been on this since 2008. So it's not like you haven't been responding to it based on what we were knowing about, and it's not just a recent thing in the last year or so. A question I had was around your standard response to a hoof to disease sequence, and you ended up saying something about hoof encapsulation or capsulate, and so just could you, what is that? Does that?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Commissioner Jennings. So the question was, I think, to clarify what I meant about the hoof capsule.
Right. You said that was a final stage sometimes? Or
yeah, so what I meant there is the hoof capsule is, we can go back to that one. Yeah. So that's just the hard part of the hoof. And actually, I'm going to...
Is that like losing your nail?
Yeah, okay. It's like sloughing the whole hard part of the hoof, leaving just tissue and bone underneath. So the hard part of the hoof, that's the capsule, is the hard part of the hoof that sloughs off.
And so then they continue to limp for a while and have the hoof grow back? Or is it gone for good?
The hoof does not grow back.
Okay, so that's the end of it.
Yeah, it's a horrible disease. As a veterinarian, it is so disturbing to me to see the suffering of these animals. It's horrible.
And then what I thought was very helpful was the online mapping tool and the visual of the data that was being reported. So if you could pull that back up real quick, I'd appreciate seeing that, because you gave us about 15 seconds and then moved on because you were trying to keep us on track. And you know, I mean, that's a pretty widespread, if I'm interpreting limping elk. And if I had to do the map over, I'd suggest making the harvested deformed always come to the top, because that seems like it's the best data. It's actually looking at it as opposed to observational. But I see a lot more, whatever that light blue is, than no limping. And when you talk about how difficult it's going to be to deal with this disease, that's a very important thing for all of us to walk away with, that we're talking about what appears to be whatever the vector is, agent, it must be fairly well distributed in the environment. We have a large population that we can't, of elk, that would be very hard to handle you know, individually to vaccinate them. And we may have to accept the fact that there aren't a lot of options that we can deal with this. One question I did have was, what do you think the what do you think is going to happen when wolves show up into this population? Because it seems like they would be targeting the animals that can run least well. There's going to be a lot of them. And at some level, they're going to help us with density control and with keeping the animals moving so they're not standing in the water maybe the way they are now because they're not, they're feeling comfortable about not having major predators around. So has that come into any of the technical discussions?
Madam Chair, Commissioner Jennings, the issue is already controversial enough. the closest wolf pack that we have right now is the Tianaway. We currently do not have sightings of wolves. We've heard some public sightings around, Packwood, Randall area, St. Helens area a little bit. But in terms of this particular corner, we haven't had many reports of wolves. Some of the basics of predator-prey ecology, where wolves are a coursing predator, chasing their prey, and if an animal is susceptible and is limping and is not as fast as its herd mates, would make it more susceptible to wolf predation. But that's as far as I'd probably go as being comfortable, giving you a little bit of a hand-waving response there, sir.
All I'm saying is I think we're all expecting wolves to be there in the not-too-distant future, and we actually sort of need them there in the not-too-distant future if we're going to get a management plan in place. So it's a new element in the equation, but one that might actually change the course of this disease in the population. That's my point.
Director Anderson, do you want to say something?
Chair, the date on this is May 23rd, 2013. Do we have any similar maps that maybe were a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and how is the change in both the geographic distribution as well as the numbers or the number of light blue circles, dark blue circles, or is this our first effort to put the data that we've collected on a map?
Madam Chair, Director Anderson, a couple thoughts. I had some maps up from 2008 and 2009, and I believe that was a result of a phone survey of hunters asking, we had a phone line where folks could call in and report. Is that what it was?
No. Do you want me to go over that study?
That'd be great. The online form came on the scene in 2012, so if you want to go through the 08.
Yeah, can you find that first, the second slide where it shows the map? So when we first started realizing we had a problem, 2008, 2009, a question in my mind was, okay, we get all these reports from a lot of different places, kind of centered around here. I just want to get my head around, okay, I want to put some parameters on this. Where is it? How widespread? How has it changed over time? And so out of my office over in Spokane, we put together a quick and dirty survey, and we sent it out to hunters in the area who had been successful in harvesting an animal there over the past, I don't know all the details. It was just kind of a quick and dirty one, and we had them send back, fill out a questionnaire about, when's the first time they saw a limping elk in this GMU? Have they harvested one in this GMU? How many, when you see a group of elk, how many are limping? It was not a rigorous study design at all. It wasn't meant to be publishable or anything. It was for me to get an idea of the magnitude of the problem. And so that's what this map is from. As I said, it's not publishable because it wasn't a great study design, but we did write a report on it, and it is on our website, and it is called Distribution and Prevalence of Elk Hoof Disease in Southwest Washington, based on hunter surveys. And the time period there was 2000 to 2009, so it was a retrospective look at things. So yes, we do have maps from 2000 to 2009, and these two are from that paper. it's not data I'm proud to wave around and say, look at my great study, because it had some deficiencies. And then it was just last fall where we started the online reporting tool that Nate showed that has all the little dots. I'd have to look at our methods again, but it may be that we did not get any reports or any information from the white areas, possibly.
Okay, I think Commissioner Mencken was next.
Yeah, I would like to echo Commissioner Jennings' comments on how fortunate we are to have people like you aboard with the technical expertise. And your presentation was very, very good and very scientific. It's not a very pretty picture. I guess I have a question, which is, are there efficacious antibacterials that can be topically administered to the hoof that are effective?
Madam Chair and Commissioner Mencken, the question is, are there topical antibiotics that are effective against
antibacterials?
The answer is yes, depending on the bacteria, and in domestic animal situations, on a dairy, for instance, topical antibiotics can be applied, but they're not effective in the presence of manure and mud and gunk because they can't penetrate. So when they are applied to dairy cattle or even to sheep for their disease, the hoof has to be cleaned, pared out, all the contamination and crud cleaned out, dried, the topical antibiotic put on, and very frequently bandaged with a bandage change every couple of days.
But what about antibacterials, like antibacterial dips? I know that when I go to a fish hatchery, mm-hmm. That you walk through an iodophore dip, which apparently is efficacious because mm-hmm. we wouldn't have them otherwise in hatcheries. Mm-hmm. Could you establish a feeding station with antibacterial dips in a shallow container that could be that the animal might have to stand in, or through some sort of matting system where the animal would not be afraid to walk onto something like that? It would be in large trays that were kept separate from, say, mud and debris, where you'd attract them in through to a feeding station. Has anybody ever tried that?
Well, that's a common practice on dairies where the cattle walk through a foot bath to and from the milking parlor to kind of reduce that level of bacteria on their feet. If there is a lot of dirt and bacteria, same with slathering on a salve or something, it's not going to penetrate the dirt. And over time, when dirt and manure builds up in those foot baths, they become ineffective, number one. And number two, all of the available foot baths are pretty nasty toxins, things that you really wouldn't want out in the environment. They could be harmful to streams, et cetera.
Yeah. Thank you. It was a long shot.
Good try.
Take them all.
Let's give Commissioner Smith, who hasn't had a chance to ask
one. Thank you. And I'll echo the sentiments of appreciation for your efforts. And as Nate started off, there's not going to be a quick, easy answer to this. And I think, as a scientist, I appreciate this. I think there's another side to monitor on this and to actively engage that's been echoed by Commissioner Schmidt and others. The social part, the science part, I'm comfortable. We're doing what we can. The social part, I think it's going to be critical because of the emotional part of all of this, the emotional appeal. We've listened to a number of very concerned citizens, very knowledgeable citizens that have ideas. I think we have to make sure that we provide a forum that the public is being heard, so that and engaged, because in the times that we live now of anti-government or conspiracy and all of that, there's a notion also that there's always a quick fix. There's a problem, you know, we don't like to see, nobody that likes to see animals suffer like this, and so why don't we fix it? Well, science doesn't work like that, you know, there's not something, but we have to maintain a dialogue, a two-way dialogue. So I just encourage us to do that from a department, to encourage input from the public and to have an output that is as user-friendly, as clear and concise, and that is possible on an ongoing basis, because if there's any breakdown in the communication flow both ways, it's going to increase the angst that's out there. And I know we're doing that. I just had to just echo that part as well. But again, thank you.
Well said. Let's give Commissioner Perry another.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been said a lot better than I could say it, but the public information flowing both ways, I think, is absolutely critical. I won't dwell on that, but just emphasize that again. I just think it's, with the passion that we saw and the people that testified in front, I think it's a very important thing to add to and continue to do with your program. The question I had was on the map with all the adults, it didn't seem to slop over into Oregon. Is that because Oregon doesn't have a problem, or we just didn't include Oregon data?
Madam Chair and Commissioner Perry, the question was, is this occurring in Oregon? And the answer is no, it is not.
Even just across the Columbia, it isn't.
Correct. As I indicated when we did our last round of collections, my counterpart at ODF&W, the veterinarian there, was with us at every single one of our collections because she wants to see what might be coming, partly. You know, in addition, she wanted to help, and she was very good, but not seen in Oregon, no.
Amazing.
Commissioner Jennings?
Just touching on the social outreach part of it, I did want to acknowledge you guys, Nate, that you said you are setting up that advisory group at a fairly high level to sort of, and that I think is going to be a very good, excellent two-way communication tool for them to, you know, so I think kudos for already being proactive on that. And I would love to see if you guys have the time and resources to get an updated prevalence and distribution map for 2013 or soon, so, you know, at a level that you feel comfortable with, so we actually know what we're looking at, because it's very easy. It's easy to deal with anecdotal data. You look at what the public's turning in, and it's nice to have something that's a little bit closer to peer reviewed. Thank you.
Others? Commissioner Caney?
Chair, I was just curious, when I shoot an elk, about the third thing that happens is the hoof comes off, because I don't want to carry the weight out, because I always been backpacking out my meat. And I'm just curious, in the magnitude of elk transmitting this disease, you know, live animals moving across the landscape, versus should there be anything put in place where animals taken under a legal hunt, should those hoofs be left in the infected area? Should they not be transported, you know, in a pickup back to Yakima where the hunter came from and thrown in a waste dump, and the dump goes out and the bacterium is now somewhere where it wasn't before? I'm just curious if you've thought that one through, or possibly some regulation that says, you know, shooting an animal in this area, leave the hoofs lay, you know, make sure they're taken off the animal or something to that effect.
Okay. Anything else? Director Anderson?
Nate, this is probably an unfair question. Do you have a estimate of the number of elk that are in the affected area?
Madam Chair, Director Anderson, for the St. Helens elk herd, as we've done the sightability model in about five of the core GMUs, were, I believe, around 13,000 animals. So some of the areas on this map, I don't have the numbers off.
But no, that gives me an idea. Thanks.
Big problem. I think this was an excellent presentation, excellent conversation. I think you've heard enough interest by the commission that we would like you to come back and just keep us briefed, because, of course, the commission serves as one of the conduits of information to the public. And I think you've heard from many of us that keeping those avenues open and keeping the communication strong and full and complete as possible is going to be one of the things that gets us through this. But I appreciated Nate's response. This is controversial enough. This is a big one. So, I think we're satisfied. What I'm hearing is the commission is satisfied that you are doing everything that is reasonable to do. So thanks. Great job.